Braces have come off her teeth, revealing a confident, frequent American smile. Her formerly shoulder-length hair has been chopped asymmetrically by one of her friends. Ashima lives in fear that Sonia will color a streak of it blonde, as Sonia has threatened on more than one occasion to do, and that she will have additional holes pierced in her earlobes at the mall. They argue violently about such things, Ashima crying, Sonia slamming doors. Some weekends his parents are invited to parties, and they insist that both Gogol and Sonia go with them. The host or hostess shows him to a room where he can study alone while the party thunders below. But he always ends up watching television with Sonia and the other children, just as he has done all his life. "I'm 18," he says once to his parents as they drive back from a party, a fact that makes no difference to them. One weekend, Gogol makes a mistake of referring to New Haven as home. "Sorry, I left it at home," he says, when his father asks if he remembered to buy the Yale decal his parents want to paste to the rear window of their car. Ashima is outraged by the remark, dwelling on it all day. "Only 3 months and listen to you," she says, telling him that after 20 years in America, she still cannot bring herself to refer to Pemberton Road as home. But now it is his room at Yale where Gogol feels most comfortable. He likes its oldness, its persistent grace. He likes that so many students have occupied it before him. He likes the solidity of its plaster walls, its dark wooden floorboards, however battered and stained. He likes the dormer window he sees first thing in the mornings when he opens his eyes and looking at Battle Chapel. He has fallen in love with the Gothic architecture of the campus, always astonished by the physical beauty that surrounds him, that roots him to his environs in a way he had never felt growing up on Pemberton Road. For his drawing class, in which he is required to make half a dozen sketches every week, he is inspired to draw the details of buildings, flying buttresses, pointed archways filled with flowing tracery, thick rounded doorways, squat columns of pale pink stone. In the spring semester, he takes an introductory class in architecture. He reads about how the pyramids and Greek temples and medieval cathedrals were built, studying the plans of churches and palaces in his textbook. He learns the endless terms, the vocabulary that classifies the details of ancient buildings, writing them on separate index cards and making illustrations on the back. Architrave, entablature, tympanum, voussoir. Together, the words form another language he longs to know. He files these index cards in a shoebox, reviews them before the exam, memorizing far more terms than he needs to, keeping the box of cards even after the exam is done, adding to them in his spare time. In the autumn of his sophomore year, he boards a particularly crowded train at Union Station. It is the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. He edges through the compartments, his duffel bag heavy with books for his Renaissance architecture class, for which he has to write a paper over the next 5 days. Passengers have already staked out parts of the vestibule, sitting glumly on their luggage. "Standing room only," the conductor hollers. "I want my money back," a passenger complains. Gogol keeps walking from one compartment to the next, looking for an uncrowded vestibule in which he might sit. In the very last car of the train, he sees an empty seat. A girl is seated next to the window, reading a folded back issue of The New Yorker. Arranged on the seat beside her is a chocolate-brown, shearling-lined suede coat, which is what had caused the person in front of Gogol to move on. But something tells Gogol the coat belongs to the girl, and so he stops and says, "Is that yours?" She lifts up her narrow body and in a single, swift motion, arranges the coat beneath her buttocks and legs. It's a face he recognizes from campus, someone he's crossed paths with in the corridors of buildings as he walks to and from class. He remembers that freshman year, she had had hair dyed an emphatic shade of cranberry red cut to her jaw. She's grown it to her shoulders now and allowed it to resume what appears to be its natural shade, light brown, with bits of blonde here and there. It is parted just off-center, a bit crooked at the base. The hair of her eyebrows is darker, lending her otherwise friendly features a serious expression. She wears a pair of nicely faded jeans, brown leather boots with yellow laces, and thick rubber soles. A cabled sweater, the same flecked gray of her eyes, is too large for her, the sleeves coming partway up her hands. A man's billfold bulges prominently from the front pocket of her jeans. "Hi, I'm Ruth," she says, recognizing him in that same vague way. "I'm Nikhil." He sits, too exhausted to put his duffel bag away in the luggage rack overhead. He shoves it as best he can under his seat, his long legs bent awkwardly, aware that he is perspiring. He unzips his blue down parka. He massages his fingers crisscrossed with welts from the leather straps of the bag. "Sorry," Ruth says, watching him. "I guess I was just trying to put off the inevitable." Still seated, he pries his arms free of the parka. "What do you mean?" "Making it look like someone was sitting here, with the coat." "It's pretty brilliant, actually. Sometimes I pretend to fall asleep for the same reason," he admits. "No one wants to sit next to me if I'm sleeping." She laughs softly, putting a strand of her hair behind her ear. Her beauty is direct, unassuming. She wears no makeup apart from something glossy on her lips. Two small brown moles by her right cheekbone are the only things that distract from the pale peach of her complexion. She has slim, small hands with unpolished nails and ragged cuticles. She leans over to put the magazine away and get a book from the bag at her feet, and he briefly glimpses the skin above her waistband. "Are you going to Boston?" he asks. "Maine. That's where my dad lives. I have to switch to a bus at South Station. It's another 4 hours from there." "What college are you in?"
"J.E.
He learns that she is in Silliman, that she's planning to be an English major. Comparing notes of their experiences at college so far, they discover that they had both taken Psychology 110 the previous spring. The book in her hands is a paperback copy of Timon of Athens, and though she keeps a finger marking her page, she never reads a word of it. Nor does he bother to open up the volume on perspective he's pulled out of his duffel. She tells him she was raised on a commune in Vermont, the child of hippies, educated at home until the 7th grade. Her parents are divorced now. Her father lives with her stepmother, raising llamas on a farm. Her mother, an anthropologist, is doing fieldwork on midwives in Thailand. He cannot imagine coming from such parents, such a background, and when he describes his own upbringing, it feels bland by comparison. But Ruth expresses interest, asking about his visits to Calcutta. She tells him her parents went to India once, to an ashram somewhere, before she was born. She asks what the streets are like, and the houses. And so, on the blank back page of his book on perspective, Goggle draws a floor plan of his maternal grandparents' flat, navigating Ruth along the verandas and the terrazzo floors, telling her about the chalky blue walls, the narrow stone kitchen, the sitting room with cane furniture that looked as if it belonged on a porch. He draws with confidence, thanks to the drafting course he has taken this term. He shows her the room where he and Sonia sleep when they visit, and describes the view of the tiny lane lined with corrugated tin-roofed businesses. When he has finished, Ruth takes the book from him and looks at the drawing he's made, trailing her finger through the rooms. "I'd love to go," she says. And suddenly, he imagines her face and arms tan, a backpack strapped to her shoulders, walking along Chowringhi as other Western tourists do, shopping in Newmarket, staying at the Grand. As they are talking, a woman across the aisle reprimands them. "She's been trying to take a nap," she says. This only goads them into talking further, in lowered voices, their heads leaning in toward each other. Goggle is unaware of which state they are in, which stations they've passed. The train rumbles over a bridge. The setting sun is feverishly beautiful, casting a striking pink glow on the facades of the clapboard houses that dot the water's edge. In minutes, these shades fade, replaced by the pallor that precedes dusk. When it is dark, he sees that their images are reflected at an angle in the glass, hovering as if outside the train. Their throats are parched from talking, and at one point he offers to go to the cafe car. She asks him to get her a bag of potato chips and a cup of tea with milk. He likes that she doesn't bother to pull the billfold out of her jeans, that she allows him to buy them for her. He returns with a coffee for himself and the chips and the tea, along with a paper cup of milk the bartender has given him instead of the regulation container of cream. They continue talking, Ruth eating the chips, brushing the salt from around her lips with the back of her hand. She offers some to Goggle, pulling them out for him one by one. He tells her about the meals he'd eaten on Indian trains the time he traveled with his family to Delhi and Agra, the rotis and slightly sour dal ordered at one station and delivered hot at the next, the thick vegetable cutlets served with bread and butter for breakfast. He tells her about the tea, how it was bought through the window from men on the platform who poured it from giant aluminum kettles, the milk and sugar already mixed in, and how it was drunk in crude clay cups that were smashed afterwards on the tracks. Her appreciation for these details flatters him. It occurs to him that he has never spoken of his experiences in India to any American friend. They part suddenly, Goggle working up the nerve to ask for a number at the last minute, writing it into the same book where he had drawn her the floor plan. He wishes he could wait with her at South Station for her bus to Maine, but he has a commuter train to catch in 10 minutes to take him to the suburbs. The days of the holiday feel endless. All he can think of is getting back to New Haven and calling Ruth. He wonders how many times they've crossed paths, how many meals they've unwittingly shared in commons. He thinks back to Psychology 110, wishing his memory would yield some image of her, taking notes on the other side of the law school auditorium, her head bent over her desk. Most often he thinks of the train, longs to sit beside her again, imagines their faces flushed from the heat of the compartment, their bodies cramped in the same way, her hair shining from the yellow lights overhead. On the ride back, he looks for her, combing each and every compartment. But she is nowhere, and he ends up sitting next to an elderly nun with a brown habit and prominent white down on her upper lip, who snores all the way. The following week, back at Yale, Ruth agrees to meet him for coffee at the Atticus bookshop. She is a few minutes late and dressed in the same jeans and boots and chocolate suede coat she'd worn when they met. Again, she asks for tea. At first he senses an awkwardness he hadn't felt on the train. The cafe feels loud and hectic, the table between them too wide. Ruth is quieter than before, looking down at her cup and playing with the sugar packets, her eyes occasionally wandering to the books that line the walls. But soon enough they are conversing easily, as they had before, exchanging tales of their respective holidays. He tells her about how he and Sonia occupied the kitchen on Pemberton Road for a day, stuffing a turkey and rolling out dough for pies, things his mother did not particularly like to do. "I looked for you on my way back," he admits to her, telling her about the snoring nun. Afterward, they walk together through the Center for British Art. There is an exhibit of Renaissance works on paper, which they've both been meaning to see. He walks her back to Silliman, and they arrange to have a coffee a few days later. After saying goodnight, Ruth lingers by the gate, looking down at the books pressed up to her chest, and he wonders if he should kiss her, which is what he's been wanting to do for hours, or whether, in her mind, they are only friends. She starts walking backward toward her entryway, smiling at him, taking an impressive number of steps before giving a final wave and turning away. He begins to meet her after classes, remembering her schedule, looking up at the buildings and hovering casually under the archways. She always seems pleased to see him, stepping away from her girlfriends to say hello. "Of course she likes you," Jonathan tells Goggle, patiently listening to a minute account of their acquaintance one night in the dining hall. A few days later, following Ruth back to her room because she's forgotten a book she needs for a class, he places his hand over hers as she reaches for the doorknob. Her roommates are out. He waits for her on the sofa in the common room as she searches for the book. It is the middle of the day, overcast, lightly raining. "Found it," she says. And though they both have classes, they remain in the room, sitting on the sofa, and kissing until it is too late to bother going. Every evening they study together at the library, sitting at either end of a table to keep from whispering. She takes him to her dining hall, and he to hers. He takes her to the sculpture garden. He thinks of her constantly, while leaning over the slanted board in his drafting class. Under the strong white lights of the studio, and in the darkened lecture hall of his Renaissance architecture class, as images of Palladian villas flash onto the screen from a slide projector. Within weeks, the end of the semester is upon them, and they are besieged by exams and papers and hundreds of pages of reading. Far more than the amount of work he faces, he dreads the month of separation they will have to endure at winter break. One Saturday afternoon, just before exams, she mentions to him in the library that both her roommates will be out all day. They walk together through cross campus, back to Silliman, and he sits with her on her unmade bed. The room smells as she does, a powdery floral smell that lacks the acridness of perfume. Postcards of authors are taped to the wall over her desk, Oscar Wilde and Virginia Woolf. Their lips and faces are still numb from the cold, and at first they still keep their coats on. They lie together against the shearling lining of hers, and she guides his hand beneath her bulky sweater. It had not been like this the first time, the only other time, that he'd been with a girl. He recalled nothing from that episode, only being thankful afterward that he was no longer a virgin. But this time he is aware of everything. The warm hollow of Ruth's abdomen, the way her lank hair rests in thick strands on the pillow, the way her features change slightly when she is lying down. "You're great, Nikhil," she whispers as he touches small breasts set wide apart, one pale nipple slightly larger than the other. He kisses them, kisses the moles scattered on her stomach as she arcs gently toward him, feels her hands on his head and then on his shoulders, guiding him between her parted legs. He feels inept, clumsy, as he tastes and smells her there, and yet he hears her whispering his name, telling him it feels wonderful. She knows what to do, unzipping his jeans, standing up at one point, and getting a diaphragm case from her bureau drawer. A week later, he is home again, helping Sonia and his mother decorate the tree, shoveling the driveway with his father, going to the mall to buy last-minute gifts. He mopes around the house, restless, pretending to be coming down with a cold. He wishes he could simply borrow his parents' car and drive up to Maine to see Ruth after Christmas, or that she could visit him. He was perfectly welcome, she'd assured him. Her father and stepmother wouldn't mind. They'd put him in the guest room, she'd said. At night, he'd creep into her bed. He imagines himself in the farmhouse she's described to him, waking up to eggs frying in a skillet, walking with her through snowy, abandoned fields. But such a trip would require telling his parents about Ruth, something he has no desire to do. He has no patience for their surprise, their nervousness, their quiet disappointment, their questions about what Ruth's parents did and whether or not the relationship was serious. As much as he longs to see her, he cannot picture her at the kitchen table on Pemberton Road, in her jeans and her bulky sweater, politely eating his mother's food. He cannot imagine being with her in the house where he is still Goggle. He speaks to her when his family is asleep, quietly in the empty kitchen, charging the calls to his telephone at school. They arrange to meet one day in Boston and spend the day together in Harvard Square. There is a foot of snow on the ground and the sky is a piercing blue. They go first to a movie at the Brattle, buying tickets for whatever is about to begin, sitting at the back of the balcony and kissing, causing people to turn back and stare. They have lunch at Café Pamplona, eating pressed ham sandwiches and bowls of garlic soup off in a corner. They exchange presents. She gives him a small used book of drawings by Goya, and he gives her a pair of blue woolen mittens and a mixtape of his favorite Beatles songs. They discover a store just above the café that sells nothing but architecture books, and he browses the aisles, treating himself to a paperback edition of Le Corbusier's Journey to the East, for he is thinking of declaring himself an architecture major in the spring. Afterward, they wander hand in hand, kissing now and then against a building, along the very streets he was pushed up and down in his stroller as a child. He shows her the American professor's house where he and his parents once lived, a time before Sonia was born, years that he has no memory of. He's seen the house in pictures, knows from his parents the name of the street. Whoever lives there now appears to be away. The snow hasn't been cleared from the porch steps, and a number of rolled-up newspapers have collected on the doormat. I wish we could go inside, he says. I wish we could be alone together. Looking at the house now, with Ruth at his side, her mittened hand in his, he feels strangely helpless. Though he was only an infant at the time, he feels nevertheless betrayed by his inability to know then that one day, years later, he would return to the house under such different circumstances, and that he would be so happy. By the following year, his parents know vaguely about Ruth. Though he has been to the farmhouse in Maine twice, meeting her father and her stepmother, Sonia, who secretly has a boyfriend these days, is the only person in his family to have met Ruth during a weekend when Sonia came to New Haven. His parents have expressed no curiosity about his girlfriend. His relationship with her is one accomplishment in his life about which they are not in the least bit proud or pleased. Ruth tells him she doesn't mind his parents' disapproval, that she finds it romantic. But Gogol knows it isn't right. He wishes his parents could simply accept her, as her family accepts him, without pressure of any kind. You're too young to get involved this way, Ashok and Ashima tell him. They've even gone so far as to point out examples of Bengali men they know who've married Americans, marriages that have ended in divorce. It only makes things worse when he says that marriage is the last thing on his mind. At times, he hangs up on them. He pities his parents when they speak to him this way, for having no experience of being young and in love. He suspects that they are secretly glad when Ruth goes away to Oxford for a semester. She'd mentioned her interest in going there long ago, in the first weeks of their courtship, when the spring of junior year had felt like a remote speck on the horizon. She'd asked him if he minded if she applied, and though the idea of her being so far had made him queasy, he'd said no, of course not, that 12 weeks would go like that. He is lost that spring without her. He spends all his time in the studio, especially the Friday nights and weekends he would normally have been with her, the two of them eating at Naples and going to see movies in the law school auditorium. He listens to the music she loves, Simon and Garfunkel, Neil Young, Cat Stevens, buying himself brand new copies of the albums she'd inherited from her parents. It sickens him to think of the physical distance between them, to think that when he is asleep at night, she's leaning over a sink somewhere, brushing her teeth and washing her face to start the next day. He longs for her as his parents have longed, all these years, for the people they love in India. For the first time in his life, he knows this feeling. But his parents refuse to give him the money to fly to England on his spring break. He spends what little money he has from working in the dining hall on transatlantic phone calls to Ruth twice a week. Twice a day, he checks his campus mailbox for letters and postcards stamped with the multicolored profiles of the Queen. He carries these letters and postcards wherever he goes, stuck into his books. My Shakespeare class is the best I've ever taken, she's written in violet-colored ink. The coffee is undrinkable. Everyone constantly says cheers. I think of you all the time. One day, he attends a panel discussion about Indian novels written in English. He feels obligated to attend. One of the presenters on the panel, Amit, is a distant cousin who lives in Bombay, whom Gogol has never met. His mother has asked him to greet Amit on her behalf. Gogol is bored by the panelists, who keep referring to something called marginality, as if it were some sort of medical condition. For most of the hour, he sketches portraits of the panelists, who sit hunched over their papers along a rectangular table. Teleologically speaking, ABCDs are unable to answer the question, where are you from, the sociologist on the panel declares. Gogol has never heard the term ABCD. He eventually gathers that it stands for American-born, confused Deshi. In other words, him. He learns that the C could also stand for conflicted. He knows that Deshi, a generic word for countryman, means Indian. Knows that his parents and all their friends always referred to India simply as Desh. But Gogol never thinks of India as Desh. He thinks of it as Americans do, as India. Gogol slouches in his seat and ponders certain awkward truths. For instance, although he can understand his mother tongue and speak it fluently, he cannot read or write it with even modest proficiency. On trips to India, his American-accented English is a source of endless amusement to his relatives. And when he and Sonia speak to each other, aunts and uncles and cousins always shake their heads in disbelief and say, "I didn't understand a word." Living with a pet name and a good name, in a place where such distinctions do not exist, surely that was emblematic of the greatest confusion of all. He searches the audience for someone he knows, but it isn't his crowd. Lots of lit majors with leather satchels and gold-rimmed glasses and fountain pens. Lots of people Ruth would have waved to. There are also lots of ABCDs. He has no idea that there are this many on campus. He has no ABCD friends at college. He avoids them, for they remind him too much of the way his parents choose to live. Befriending people not so much because they like them, but because of a past they happen to share. "Gogol, why aren't you a member of the Indian Association here?" Amit asks later when they go for a drink at the Anchor. "I just don't have the time," Gogol says, not telling his well-meaning cousin that he can think of no greater hypocrisy than joining an organization that willingly celebrates occasions his parents forced him throughout his childhood and adolescence to attend. "I'm Nikhil now," Gogol says, suddenly depressed by how many more times he will have to say this, asking people to remember, reminding them to forget, feeling as if an errata slip were perpetually pinned to his chest. Thanksgiving of his senior year, he takes the train, alone, up to Boston. He and Ruth are no longer together. Instead of coming back from Oxford after those 12 weeks, she'd stayed on to do a summer course, explaining that a professor she admired would be retiring after that. Gogol had spent the summer on Pemberton Road. He had had an unpaid internship at a small architecture firm in Cambridge, where he had run errands at Charette for the designers, been sent to photograph nearby sites, lettered a few drawings. To make money, he worked nights washing dishes at an Italian restaurant in his parents' town. Late in August, he'd gone to Logan to welcome Ruth home. He had waited for her at the arrival gate, taken her to a hotel for one night, paying for it with the money he had made at the restaurant. The room overlooked the public garden, its walls covered with thickly striped pink and cream paper. They'd made love for the first time in a double bed. They'd gone out for their meals, neither of them able to afford the items on the room service menu. They walked up Newbury Street and went to a Greek restaurant with tables on the sidewalk. The day was blazing hot. Ruth looked the same, but her speech was peppered with words and phrases she'd picked up in England, like, "I imagine," and "I suppose," and "presumably." She spoke of her semester and how much she'd liked England, the traveling she'd done in Barcelona and Rome. She wanted to go back to England for graduate school, she said. "I imagine they've got good architecture schools," she had added. "You could come as well." The next morning, he'd put her on the bus to Maine. But within days of being together again in New Haven, in an apartment he'd rented on House Street with friends, they'd begun fighting, both admitting in the end that something had changed. They avoid each other now, when they happen to cross paths in the library and on the streets. He's scratched out her phone number and the addresses he'd written down for her at Oxford and in Maine. But boarding the train, it is impossible not to think of the afternoon, 2 years ago, they'd met. As usual, the train is incredibly crowded, and this time he sits for half the journey in the vestibule. After Westerly, he finds a seat, and settles down with a course selection guide for next semester. But he feels distracted for some reason, gloomy, impatient to be off the train. He does not bother to remove his coat, does not bother to go to the cafe car for something to drink even though he is thirsty. He puts away the course guide and opens up a library book that might be helpful for his senior thesis project, a comparison between Renaissance Italian and Mughal palace design. But after a few paragraphs, he closes this book as well. His stomach growls, and he wonders what there will be for dinner at home, what his father has prepared. His mother and Sonia have gone to India for 3 weeks to attend a cousin's wedding, and this year, Gogol and his father will spend Thanksgiving at the home of friends. He angles his head against the window and watches the autumnal landscape pass, the spewing pink and purple waters of a dye mill, electrical power stations, a big ball-shaped water tank covered with rust. Abandoned factories with rows of small square windows partly bashed in, ravaged as if by moths. On the trees, The topmost branches are bare, the remaining leaves yellow, paper thin. The train moves more slowly than usual, and when he looks at his watch, he sees that they are running well behind schedule. And then, somewhere outside Providence, in an abandoned, grassy field, the train stops. For over an hour, they stand there as a solid, scarlet disk of sun sinks into the tree-lined horizon. The lights turn off, and the air inside the train turns uncomfortably warm. The conductors rush anxiously through the compartments. "Probably a broken wire," the gentleman sitting beside Goggle remarks. Across the aisle, a gray-haired woman reads, a coat clutched like a blanket to her chest. Behind him, two students discuss the poems of Ben Jonson. Without the sound of the engine, Goggle can hear an opera playing faintly on someone's Walkman. Through the window, he admires the darkening sapphire sky. He sees spare lengths of rusted rails heaped in piles. It isn't until they start moving again that an announcement is made on the loudspeaker about a medical emergency. But the truth, overheard by one of the passengers from a conductor, quickly circulates. A suicide had been committed. A person had jumped in front of the train. He is shocked and discomfited by the news, feeling bad about his irritation and impatience, wondering if the victim had been a man or a woman, young or old. He imagines the person consulting the same schedule that's in his backpack, determining exactly when the train would be passing through. The approach of the train's headlights. As a result of the delay, he misses his commuter rail connection in Boston, waits another 40 minutes for the next one. He puts a call through to his parents' house, but no one answers. He tries his father's department at the university, but there too the phone rings and rings. At the station, he sees his father waiting on the darkened platform, wearing sneakers and corduroys, anxiousness in his face. A trench coat is belted around his waist, a scarf knitted by Ashima wrapped at his throat, a tweed cap on his head. "Sorry I'm late," Goggle says. "How long have you been waiting?" "Since 5:45, his father says. Goggle looks at his watch. It is nearly 8. "There was an accident." "I know, I called. What happened? Were you hurt?" Goggle shakes his head. "Someone jumped onto the tracks, somewhere in Rhode Island. I tried to call you. They had to wait for the police, I think." "I was worried." "I hope you haven't been standing out in the cold all this time," Goggle says, and from his father's lack of response, he knows that this is exactly what he has done. Goggle wonders what it is like for his father to be without his mother and Sonia. He wonders if he is lonely. But his father is not the type to admit such things, to speak openly of his desires, his moods, his needs. They walk to the parking lot, get into the car, and begin the short drive home. The night is windy, so much so that the car jostles slightly from time to time, and brown leaves as large as human feet fly across the road in the headlights' glare. Normally on these rides back from the station, his father asks questions about his classes, about his finances, about his plans after graduation. But tonight they are silent, Ashok concentrating on driving. Goggle fidgets with the radio, switching from the AM news station to NPR. "I want to tell you something," his father says when the piece ends, once they have already turned onto Pemberton Road. "What?" Goggle asks. "It's about your name." Goggle looks at his father, puzzled. "My name?" His father shuts off the radio. "Goggle." These days he is called Goggle so seldom that the sound of it no longer upsets him as it used to. After 3 years of being Nikhil, the vast majority of the time, he no longer minds. "There is a reason for it, you know," his father continues. "Right, Baba. Goggle's your favorite author. I know." "No," his father says. He pulls into the driveway and switches off the engine, then the headlights. He undoes his seatbelt, guiding it with his hand as it retracts, back behind his left shoulder. "Another reason." And as they sit together in the car, his father revisits a field 209 kilometers from Howrah. With his fingers lightly grasping the bottom of the steering wheel, his gaze directed through the windshield at the garage door, he tells Goggle the story of the train he'd ridden 28 years ago in October 1961, on his way to visit his grandfather in Jamshedpur. He tells him about the night that had nearly taken his life, and the book that had saved him, and about the year afterward, when he had been unable to move. Goggle listens, stunned, his eyes fixed on his father's profile. Though there are only inches between them, for an instant his father is a stranger, a man who has kept a secret, has survived a tragedy, a man whose past he does not fully know, a man who is vulnerable, who has suffered in an inconceivable way. He imagines his father in his 20s, as Goggle is now, sitting on a train, as Goggle had just been, reading a story, and then suddenly nearly killed. He struggles to picture the West Bengal countryside he has seen on only a few occasions, his father's mangled body among hundreds of dead ones, being carried on a stretcher past a twisted length of maroon compartments. Against instinct, he tries to imagine life without his father, a world in which his father does not exist. "Why don't I know this about you?" Goggle says. His voice sounds harsh, accusing, but his eyes well with tears. "Why haven't you told me this until now?" "It never felt like the right time," his father says. "But it's like you've lied to me all these years." When his father doesn't respond, he adds, "That's why you have that limp, isn't it?" "It happened so long ago, I didn't want to upset you." "It doesn't matter. You should have told me." "Perhaps," his father concedes, glancing briefly in Goggle's direction. He removes the keys from the ignition. "Come, you must be hungry. The car is getting cold." But Goggle doesn't move. He sits there, still struggling to absorb the information, feeling awkward, oddly ashamed, at fault. "I'm sorry, Baba." His father laughs softly. "You had nothing to do with it." "Does Sonia know?" His father shakes his head. "Not yet. I'll explain it to her one day. In this country, only your mother knows. And now you. I've always meant for you to know, Goggle." And suddenly the sound of his pet name, uttered by his father as he has been accustomed to hearing it all his life, means something completely new, bound up with a catastrophe he has unwittingly embodied for years. "Is that what you think of when you think of me?" Goggle asks him. "Do I remind you of that night?" "Not at all," his father says eventually, one hand going to his ribs, a habitual gesture that has baffled Goggle until now. "You remind me of everything that followed." Chapter 6, 1994. He lives in New York now. In May, he graduated from the architecture program at Columbia. He's been working since then for a firm in Midtown, with celebrated large-scale commissions to its name. It's not the sort of job he'd envisioned for himself as a student. Designing and renovating private residences was what he'd wanted to do. That might come later, his advisors have told him. For now, it was important to apprentice with the big names. And so, facing the tawny brick wall of a neighboring building across the air shaft, he works with a team on designs for hotels and museums and corporate headquarters in cities he's never seen: Brussels, Buenos Aires, Abu Dhabi, Hong Kong. His contributions are incidental and never fully his own. A stairwell, a skylight, a corridor, an air conditioning duct. Still, he knows that each component of a building, however small, is nevertheless essential. And he finds it gratifying that after all his years of schooling, all his crits and unbuilt projects, his efforts are to have some practical end. He typically works late into his evenings, and on most of his weekends, drawing designs on the computer, drafting plans, writing specifications, building styrofoam and cardboard models to scale. He goes home to a studio in Morningside Heights, with two windows facing west on Amsterdam Avenue. The entrance is easy to miss, a scratched-up glass door between a newsstand and a nail salon. It's the first apartment he has to himself, after an evolving chain of roommates all through college and graduate school. There is so much street noise that when he's on the phone and the windows are open, People often ask if he's calling from a payphone. The kitchen is built into what should have been an entryway, a space so small that the refrigerator stands several feet away, over by the bathroom door. On the stove sits a tea kettle he has never filled with water, and on the countertop, a toaster he's never plugged in. His parents are distressed by how little money he makes, and occasionally his father sends him checks in the mail to help him with his rent, his credit card bills. They had been disappointed that he'd gone to Columbia. They'd hoped he would choose MIT, the other architecture program to which he'd been accepted. But after 4 years in New Haven, he didn't want to move back to Massachusetts, to the one city in America his parents know. He didn't want to attend his father's alma mater and live in an apartment in Central Square as his parents once had, and revisit the streets about which his parents speak nostalgically. He didn't want to go home on the weekends, to go with them to Pujos and Bengali parties, to remain unquestionably in their world. He prefers New York, a place which his parents do not know well, whose beauty they are blind to, which they fear. He'd come to know the city slightly during his years at Yale, on visits with architecture classes. He'd been to a few parties at Columbia. Sometimes he and Ruth would ride in on Metro North, and they would go to museums or to the Village, or to browse for books at the Strand. But as a child, he'd been to New York only once with his family, a trip that had given him no sense of what the city was like. They had gone one weekend to visit Bengali friends who lived in Queens. Their friends had given his family a tour of Manhattan. Gogol had been 10 years old, Sonia 4. "I want to see Sesame Street," Sonia had said, believing that it was an actual landmark in the city. And she had cried when Gogol had laughed at her, saying it didn't exist. On the tour, they were driven past sites like Rockefeller Center and Central Park and the Empire State Building, and Gogol had ducked his head below the car's window to try to see how tall the buildings were. His parents had remarked endlessly at the amount of traffic, the pedestrians, the noise. Calcutta was no worse, they had said. He remembered wanting to get out and go to the top of one of the skyscrapers, the way his father had once taken him to the top of the Prudential Center in Boston when he was little. But they were allowed out of the car only once they got to Lexington Avenue, to eat lunch at an Indian restaurant, and then to buy Indian groceries and polyester saris and 220-volt appliances to give to relatives in Calcutta. This, to his parents, was what one came to Manhattan to do. He remembered wishing that his parents would walk through the park, take him to the Museum of Natural History to see the dinosaurs, ride the subway even. But they had had no interest in such things. One night, Evan, one of the draftsmen at work with whom he is friendly, talks him into going to a party. Evan tells Gogol that it's an apartment worth seeing, a Tribeca loft that happens to be designed by one of the partners at the firm. The host of the party, Russell, an old friend of Evan, works for the UN and has spent several years in Kenya. And as a result, the loft is filled with an impressive collection of African furniture and sculpture and masks. Gogol imagines that it will be a party of hundreds filling up a vast space, the sort of party where he might arrive and leave undetected. But by the time Gogol and Evan get there, the party is nearly over, and there are only a dozen or so people sitting around a low coffee table surrounded by cushions, eating picked-over grapes and cheese. At one point, Russell, who is diabetic, raises his shirt and injects himself in the stomach with insulin. Beside Russell is a woman Gogol can't stop looking at. She's kneeling on the floor at Russell's side, spreading a generous amount of brie on a cracker, paying no attention to what Russell is doing. Instead, she is arguing with a man on the other side of the coffee table about a movie by Buñuel. "Oh, come on," she keeps saying. "It was brilliant." At once strident and flirtatious, she's a little bit drunk. She has dirty blonde hair gathered sloppily into a bun, strands falling randomly, attractively, around her face. Her forehead is high and smooth, her jawbone sloping and unusually long. Her eyes are greenish, the irises encased by thin rings of black. She is dressed in silk capri pants and a sleeveless white shirt that shows off her tan. "What did you think of it?" she asks Gogol, drawing him without warning into the discussion. When he tells her he hasn't seen the film, she looks away. She approaches him again as he is standing idle, looking up at an imposing wooden mask that hangs above a suspended metal staircase. The hollow diamond-shaped eyes and mouth of the mask revealing the white brick wall behind it.
There's an even scarier one in the bedroom, she says, making a face, shuddering.
Imagine opening your eyes and seeing something like that first thing in the morning.
The way she says this makes him wonder if she speaks from experience, if she's Russell's lover or ex-lover, if that is what she's implying.
Her name is Maxine. She asks him about the program at Columbia, mentioning that she'd gone to Barnard for college, majoring in art history. She leans back against a column as she speaks, smiling at him easily, drinking a glass of champagne. At first, he assumes she is older than he is, closer to 30 than 20. He is surprised to learn that she'd graduated from college the year after he started graduate school, that for a year they overlapped at Columbia, living just 3 blocks away from each other, and that they have in all likelihood crossed paths on Broadway or walking up the steps of Lowe Library or in Avery. It reminds him of Ruth, of the way they too had once lived in such close proximity as strangers. Maxine tells him she works as an assistant editor for a publisher of art books. Her current project is a book on Andrea Mantegna, and he impresses her, remembering correctly, that his frescoes are in Mantua, in the Palazzo Ducale. They speak in that slightly strained, silly way that he associates now with flirtation. The exchange feels desperately arbitrary, fleeting. It is the sort of conversation he might have had with anybody. But Maxine has a way of focusing her attention on him completely, her pale, watchful eyes holding his gaze, making him feel, for those brief minutes, the absolute center of her world. The next morning she calls, waking him. At 10 on a Sunday, he is still in bed, his head aching from the scotch and sodas he had consumed throughout the evening. He answers gruffly, a bit impatiently, expecting it to be his mother calling to ask how his week has been. He has the feeling from the tone of Maxine's voice that she's been up for hours, that her breakfast has already been eaten, her times thoroughly read. "It's Maxine, from last night," she says, not bothering to apologize for waking him. She tells him she'd found his number in the phone book, though he doesn't remember telling her his last name. "God, your apartment's noisy," she remarks. Then, without awkwardness or pause, she invites him to dinner at her place. She specifies the evening, a Friday, tells him the address, somewhere in Chelsea. He assumes it will be a dinner party, asks if there's anything he can bring, but she says no, it will just be him. "I should probably warn you that I live with my parents," she adds. "Oh." This unexpected piece of information deflates him, confuses him. He asks if her parents will mind his coming over, if perhaps they should meet at a restaurant instead. But she laughs at this suggestion in a way that makes him feel vaguely foolish. Why on earth would they mind? He takes a cab from his office to her neighborhood, getting out at a liquor store to buy a bottle of wine. It is a cool evening in September, raining steadily, the summer's leaves still plentiful on the trees. He turns onto a remote, tranquil block between 9th and 10th Avenues. It is his first date in a long time. With the exception of a few forgettable affairs at Columbia, he's been with no one seriously since Ruth. He doesn't know what to make of the whole arrangement with Maxine, but as odd as the terms of the invitation seem, he had been unable to refuse. He is curious about her, attracted, flattered by the boldness of her pursuit. He is stunned by the house, a Greek revival, admiring it for several minutes like a tourist before opening the gate. He notes the pedimented window lintels, the Doric pilasters, the bracketed entablature, the black cruciform panel door. He climbs a low stoop with cast iron railings. The name below the bell is Ratliff. Several minutes after he presses it, enough to make him double-check the address on a scrap of paper in his jacket pocket, Maxine arrives. She kisses him on the cheek, leaning toward him on one foot, the other leg extended, slightly raised behind her. She's barefoot, wearing flowing black wool pants and a thin beige cardigan. As far as he can tell, she wears nothing under the cardigan apart from her bra. Her hair is done up in the same careless way. His raincoat is draped on a coat rack, his folding umbrella dropped into a stand. He glimpses himself quickly in a mirror in the foyer, smoothing his hair and his tie. She leads him down a flight of stairs to a kitchen
that appears to occupy an entire floor of the house, with a large farmhouse table at one end, and beyond that French doors leading to a garden. The walls are adorned with prints of roosters and herbs and an arrangement of copper skillets. Ceramic plates and platters are displayed on open shelves, along with what seem to be hundreds of cookbooks, food encyclopedias, and volumes of essays about eating. A woman stands at a butcher block island by the appliances, snipping the ends of a pile of green beans with a pair of scissors. "This is my mother, Lydia," Maxine says. "And this is Silas," she tells him, pointing to a reddish-brown cocker spaniel dozing under the table. Lydia is tall and slender like her daughter, with straight iron-colored hair cut youthfully to frame her face. She's carefully dressed, with gold jewelry at her ears and throat, a navy apron wrapped around her waist, gleaming black leather shoes. Though her face is lined and her complexion a bit splotchy, she is more beautiful even than Maxine, her features more regular, the cheekbones higher, the eyes more elegantly defined. "Lovely to meet you, Nikhil," she says, smiling brightly, and though she looks at him with interest, she does not pause in her work or offer to shake his hand. Maxine pours him a glass of wine, not asking if perhaps he might prefer something else. "Come on," she says, "I'll show you the house." She leads him up 5 flights of uncarpeted stairs that creak noisily beneath their combined weight. The plan of the house is simple. 2 immense rooms per floor, each of which, he is certain, is larger than his own apartment. Politely he admires the Plaster Cove moldings, the ceiling medallions, the marble mantelpieces, things he knows how to speak intelligently and at length about. The walls are painted in flamboyant colors, hibiscus pink, lilac, pistachio, and are crowded with clusters of paintings and drawings and photographs. In one room he sees an oil portrait of a small girl he assumes is Maxine, sitting in the lap of a stunning, youthful Lydia, wearing a yellow sleeveless dress. Along the hallways, on every floor, shelves ascend to the ceiling, crammed with all the novels one should read in a lifetime, biographies, massive monographs of every artist, all the architecture books Gogol has ever coveted. Alongside the clutter, there is a starkness about the place that appeals to him. The floors are bare, the woodwork stripped, many of the windows without curtains to highlight their generous proportions. Maxine has the top floor to herself, a peach-colored bedroom with a sleigh bed at the back, a long black and red bathroom. The shelf above the sink is full of different creams for her neck, her throat, her eyes, her feet, daytime, nighttime, sun, and shade. Through the bedroom is a gray sitting room she treats as a closet, her shoes and handbags and clothes scattered across the floor, piled on a fainting couch, spilling over the backs of chairs. These patches of disorder make no difference. It is a house too spectacular to suffer distraction, forgiving of oversight and mess. "Lovely frieze-band windows," he comments, looking toward the ceiling. She turns to him puzzled. "What?" "That's what those are called," he explains, pointing. "They're fairly common in houses from this period." She looks up and then at him, seeming impressed. "I never knew that." He sits with Maxine on the fainting couch, leafing through a coffee table book she'd helped to edit on 18th century French wallpapers, one side of the book resting on each of their knees. She tells him this is the house she's grown up in, mentioning casually that she'd moved back 6 months ago after living with a man in Boston, an arrangement that had not worked out. When he asks if she plans to look for a place of her own, she says it hasn't occurred to her. "It's such a bother renting a place in the city," she says. "Besides, I love this house. There's really nowhere else I'd rather live." For all her sophistication, he finds the fact that she's moved back with her parents after a love affair has soured endearingly old-fashioned. It is something he cannot picture himself doing at this stage in his life. At dinner, he meets her father, a tall, good-looking man with luxuriant white hair. Maxine's pale green-gray eyes, thin rectangular glasses perched halfway down his nose. "How do you do? I'm Gerald," he says, nodding, shaking Goggle's hand. Gerald gives him a bunch of cutlery and cloth napkins and asks him to set the table. Goggle does as he is told, aware that he is touching the everyday possessions of a family he barely knows. "You'll sit here, Nikhil," Gerald says, pointing to a chair once the silverware is laid. Goggle takes his place on one side of the table, across from Maxine. Gerald and Lydia are at either end. Goggle had skipped lunch that day in order to leave the office in time for the date with Maxine, and already the wine, at once heavier and smoother than what he is used to drinking, has gone to his head. He feels a pleasant ache at his temples and a sudden gratitude for the day and where it has brought him. Maxine lights a pair of candles. Gerald tops off the wine. Lydia serves the food on broad white plates, a thin piece of steak rolled into a bundle and tied with string, sitting in a pool of dark sauce, the green beans boiled so that they are still crisp. A bowl of small, round, roasted red potatoes is passed around, and afterward, a salad. They eat appreciatively, commenting on the tenderness of the meat, the freshness of the beans. His own mother would never have served so few dishes to a guest. She would have kept her eyes trained on Maxine's plate, insisting she have seconds and then thirds. The table would have been lined with a row of serving bowls so that people could help themselves. But Lydia pays no attention to Goggle's plate. She makes no announcement indicating that there is more. Silas sits at Lydia's feet as they eat, and at one point Lydia slices off a generous portion of her meat and feeds it to him off of her palm. The four of them go quickly through two bottles of wine, then move on to a third. The Ratcliffes are vociferous at the table, opinionated about things his own parents are indifferent to, movies, exhibits at museums, good restaurants, the design of everyday things. They speak of New York, of stores and neighborhoods and buildings they either despise or love, with an intimacy and ease that make Goggle feel as if he barely knows the city. They speak about the house, which Gerald and Lydia bought back in the 70s, when no one wanted to live in the area, about the history of the neighborhood, and about Clement Clark Moore, who Gerald explains was a professor of classics at the seminary across the street. He was the person responsible for local residential zoning, Gerald says. That, and writing Twas the Night Before Christmas, of course. Goggle is unaccustomed to this sort of talk at mealtimes, to the indulgent ritual of the lingering meal, and the pleasant aftermath of bottles and crumbs and empty glasses that clutter the table. Something tells him that none of this is for his benefit, that this is the way the Ratcliffes eat every night. Gerald is a lawyer, Lydia is a curator of textiles at the Met. They are at once satisfied and intrigued by his background, by his years at Yale and Columbia, his career as an architect, his Mediterranean looks. "You could be Italian," Lydia remarks at one point during the meal, regarding him in the candle's glow. Gerald remembers a bar of French chocolate he bought on his way home, and this is unwrapped, broken apart, and passed around the table. Eventually the talk turns to India. Gerald asks questions about the recent rise of Hindu fundamentalism, a topic Goggle knows little about. Lydia talks at length about Indian carpets and miniatures. Maxine about a college class she'd once taken on Buddhist stupas. They have never known a person who has been to Calcutta. Gerald has an Indian colleague at work who just went to India for his honeymoon. He'd brought back spectacular photographs of a palace built on a lake. Was that in Calcutta? "That's Udaipur," Goggle tells him. "I've never been there. Calcutta's in the east, closer to Thailand." Lydia peers into the salad bowl, fishing out a stray piece of lettuce and eating it with her fingers. She seems more relaxed now, quicker to smile, her cheeks rosy from the wine. "What's Calcutta like? Is it beautiful?" The question surprises him. He is accustomed to people asking about the poverty, about the beggars, and the heat. "Parts of it are beautiful," he tells her. "There's a lot of lovely Victorian architecture left over from the British, but most of it's decaying." "That sounds like Venice," Gerald says. "Are there canals?" "Only during monsoons. That's when the streets flood. I guess that's the closest it comes to resembling Venice." "I want to go to Calcutta," Maxine says, as if this has been a thing denied to her all her life. She gets up and walks over to the stove. "I feel like tea. Who wants tea?" But Gerald and Lydia decide against tea tonight. There is an I, Claudius video they want to watch before bed. Without tending to the dishes, they stand up, Gerald taking their two glasses and the rest of the wine. "Good night, dear," Lydia says, kissing Goggle lightly on the cheek, and then their footsteps creak noisily up the stairs. I suppose you've never been subjected to someone's parents on the first date before. Maxine says once they are alone, sipping milky cups of Lapsang Souchong from heavy white mugs.